everyone. Welcome to In Your Element from Tetramap, where our focus is on developing people and business the way nature intended. Our guests will be sharing their expertise on what it's like when you're working in your element and working in a great team where people value each other's differences. I'm Louise Duncan, your host, and look forward to sharing this with you in the coming weeks. Well, today's guest is Dr. Matthew Adams from the UK. And to provide a bit of an introduction, Matthew is a principal lecturer in psychology at the University of Brighton. And in both teaching and research, he's an advocate of the psychological, cultural, and social approaches of distress that challenge both medical and individualistic models. And Matt has taken enormous amounts of research and written extensively on the healing benefits of nature and human nature relations in an era really of unprecedented ecological crisis that we're all very much aware of. And he's written several books, but his most recent one is called Anthropocene Psychology, Being Human, in a More Than Human World. And that was just published this year. So quite a body of work that Matt has been building over the years. And recently I read his article on LinkedIn, and it was called A Radical Nature-Based Agenda Would Help Society Overcome the Psychological Effects of Coronavirus. And I was absolutely delighted when Matt accepted my invitation to be a guest on the podcast. So Matt, it's absolutely pleasure to have you with us today for the In Your Element podcast.
Hi, Louise. Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here, and thanks for that introduction. Two of my big interests are ecological crisis, but nature, relationships with nature in that context. So, yeah, I'm sure we're going to have a really interesting conversation today.
I'm really looking forward to it. Yeah. So first of all, I'd like to say thank you for your research about the benefits of nature. And I know it's not just you that does it, but it does have massive links to mental health. And that's clearly something that is a really big issue being talked about at the moment, but also the social aspects of going out as a group to learn and explore. And it's something that at Tetramap, whilst our model is based on metaphor, the metaphorical aspects of learning through nature, we strongly advocate for all our learners. And I'd just like to make it clear that Matt doesn't really know Tetramap, but we're just connected through this real interest in nature and how nature can be healing attribute for people who are in work or even and those who are not. So yeah, I was so keen to learn and hear from you today, Matt, and I'm really excited to hear what you build on the findings that you've read and learn from your expertise.
Thanks. Yeah, great. Look forward to it.
So to kick off, I mean, let's just do this. We decided to call the podcast In Your Element. So let's learn a little bit more about you. It describes us a little, but let's find out more about uniquely being Matt. So Matt, when you're in your element, what are you doing, thinking or feeling?
Ah, Louise, that's a really nice question. So when I'm in my element, I'm especially at ease. Or in the moment, I guess that's what that term means, but certainly what it means to me. Mm. Okay, if I can conjure a kind of situation, a kind of composite memory of when I feel in my element, including all the elements of feeling in my element, I think it would be dusk. I've probably been out walking all day, probably with friends, in one of those landscapes that's so expansive you can't really take it all in one go, familiar to you in New Zealand, I'm sure.
Very.
And we're on the final stretch. I think we'd have to be on the final stretch for me to be in my final element. So we've done a fair bit of work, walking work, and we're probably walking towards a place where we know we're going to gather. So something convivial, a fire, a pub, a drink, maybe. Yeah, so I think at those kind of moments are when I really feel in my element, yeah. I mean, I've often been and still am very active in nature, climbing, cycling, hiking, and often with others. And I love that feeling of being alive and in the moment in nature.
Yeah. And how interesting that you were saying that you were taking a pause, almost being at the end, feeling that sense of I'm with my friends, we've done some work, and now we're going to share a drink. And I knew the pub was going to come into it somewhere, being from Britain. We both are.
Yeah.
Oh, dear, that's great. But it is true, those expansiveness of looking at a big horizon, a big landscape, just allows you to reflect and also to look ahead, I think. So that sounds like a wonderful opportunity to just be there in the moment, as you said. And you mentioned nature quite a bit. So why is nature so important to you, Matt?
I've always felt like, ever since I've been aware of nature as nature, that a deep attachment I genuinely have. I think for me, it's a really important way of feeling. I might be using therapeutic language here, but just feeling held, which is more like, I suppose, in everyday language, being grounded in some way.
Right.
I don't want to get overly spiritual here, but I do recognize a kind of all too fleeting sense of being, just for a moment, in unison, a way of feeling that somehow means we as individual selves are kind of enfolded into this living world around us. And for that second, and it can sometimes only be a second, it doesn't feel like it's me and nature. It's something else, a sense of belonging, of being one with something beyond our human selves. It feels kind of transcendent, but also really ordinary and familiar. So I like the fact you mentioned a pause there. So despite actually what I said about being wanting to be active in nature, I think the moments that are most important to me, most powerful in my experience, are those pauses. It's the moment to dry off in the sun or rest one's legs or, you know, stop and sit for a moment. And it's then when everything kind of settles into place in a way that, well, I suppose it's indescribable, but I'm sure lots of listeners have had that experience. It's fleeting, but it's real. And I suppose that's really actually when I'm closest to being in my element too. That's why it's important. Nature is important to me because it exists for its own sake, in its own right. That's part of this feeling, part and parcel of it, oddly. I feel that really strongly, not as a philosophical position so much, but as that, a deep feeling, the kind of enduring presence, lively social presence, but within and in relation to nature.
And the aspect of human nature interconnecting with nature. I mean, humans, as we know, are part of nature. So anything you'd like to add on that, Matt?
Well, I think we imagine and we've been brought up with a worldview that sees humans and nature as separate, even though, of course, as you said, we're a part and parcel of nature. Those moments where we do personally experience being part of nature are really powerful experiences for us as humans too, because it's when we do get that sense of connection that takes us beyond those everyday concerns where we can often think of ourselves as exceptional or outside of nature somehow. So really important learning experiences, which is maybe something we'll come back to.
Definitely. That was fascinating. Thank you, Matt. And just as part of our preparation, I asked you if you had a short reading or a favourite quote that you'd like to share with the listeners. And I wondered if you could tell us which one you've chosen and, you know, share it with us.
I'd love to, Louise. Yeah. So I love poetry. I just think it's a wonderful medium. And especially in this context, actually, I think perhaps poetry, when it's good, is better than anything at using words to capture what cannot be said. But I've chosen a poem, a short poem by William Martin. And it's actually from a kind of parental guide from a book called The Parents' Tao Te Ching, Ancient Advice for Modern Parents. So I've got it here, so I'll just read it out to you. It's not a long poem.
Great.
Do not ask your children to strive for extraordinary lives. Such striving may seem admirable, but it is the way of foolishness. Help them instead to find the wonder and the marvel of an ordinary life. Show them the joy of tasting tomatoes, apples, and pears. Show them how to cry when pets and people die. Show them the infinite pleasure in the touch of a hand and make the ordinary come alive for them. The extraordinary will take care of itself.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That is amazing. I've never heard of William Martin before, but what a spine-tingling poem. Thank you. And it's interesting that you talk about words, and clearly you're a very good writer, but poetry is something that I think is also almost like therapeutic for people, to be able to write a short poem or put something, words to paper. And that was just amazing. And I think that if every parent read that, it would really add value to the way that we all bring up our children. We're always are encouraging them, hey, go for this, go for that, go for the other. But just to encourage them to do the ordinary. What a powerful quote or poem that was. I loved it. Thank you.
Oh, good. I'm really glad you liked it. Thanks. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And I love it for the same reasons as you're saying, I'm sure. You know, it's just in some ways it goes against some of the things we're taught to teach our children. But in other ways, of course, it's so it can chime with many of us in our experience when we remember what's important. And of course, for me, that strongly connects to touch, and the ordinary coming alive is about those everyday connections with nature too. That's part and parcel of that.
Well, thank you, Matt. And I'm going to put that poem in the show notes with the author so that people can go back and read it again if they so wish. Thank you. All right, so let's just take our next question. And really, one of the things I wanted to talk more was about your work. And I just wondered if you had a story that you'd like to share or talk a little bit further about the article, which was so inspiring for me to read. What's been something that's been really meaningful or a surprise or highlight or the biggest learning for you?
Yeah, thanks, Louise. That's another really nice question. It's got me thinking. So, yeah, the article that you're talking about there is one where what I set out there is a kind of radical agenda for encouraging more access to nature as a right, almost. Well, not almost, as a right, you know, because of the well-being benefits of access to nature are so well established now. There's a strong argument for making it a right, especially as some groups don't have the same kinds of access. But what I want to talk about here in terms of a kind of highlight or a learning experience was what's led me to that position where I feel, not just think, but feel so passionately about access to nature. Mm. And a great learning experience for me, actually, has been a real privilege of working outside in nature with different groups. And that is a privilege for me because I am an academic, I'm a lecturer, so I often work inside. Basically. But working outside in nature with different groups to help them evaluate often projects that are around nature connection has been really important for me as a kind of yang to the yin of teaching and writing about the importance of nature connection. So if I just draw one example out of that experience, I suppose there are so many, but I do run a course for undergraduate psychology students every year. It's called Eco-Psychology. That's what I call the course. And as part of their learning, we take them outside. I say we because it's a collaboration with a professional who runs outdoor wellbeing and nature courses. So we start in the classroom. It's usually at week one or two, so very early. We tell them a little bit about what's going to happen. But then, depending on the time of year, we have to get wrapped up. But then we head out. Just a few simple activities. Nothing too scary for them. Into some local nature area. We return after an hour or so. And this is the moment for me. This is the experience that's so important, is when we come back. I mean, they all nearly always really engage with the process, whatever their attitude or what they're giving off beforehand. But a real regular highlight for me is seeing the difference in energy and atmosphere from when we sat in the classroom beforehand, when these students, often young people, are nervous or maybe appearing to be bored or indifferent, compared to when we return. There's such a lively buzz. But it's also grounded in a way. There's a calmness to it, both at the same time. And that happens so often. It's so reliable. I've been running these kinds of sessions for 8-9 years now. It's still a surprise. And it's still a real highlight for me, those kinds of experiences. And seeing those kind of tangible benefits, really, for all sorts of groups are what motivates me to be so passionate about access to nature as something that we should all have.
Mm. And Matt, you talked about the buzz that comes back, a lively buzz, that when they come back, there's a lively buzz. Can you link that to something? Can you pinpoint that? Have you been able to pinpoint what has triggered that lively buzz?
That's a really good question. And I suppose I can. I mean, I can connect it to some of the more academic learning and literature about the power of nature connection, I suppose.
Yeah.
And that's partly about maybe some things we'll go into in a bit more depth, but it's partly about going out, being in nature, the bodily movement that happens, the bodily engagement, the embodied feeling of being outdoors, having to move around, taking things in with your senses. I mean, it's obvious. It really is obvious, but we take it for granted that we should teach indoors, or, you know, we shouldn't be moving, or we shouldn't be outdoors. But just that very process itself for learning is really important, but also the social development there, I think, is really important. Perhaps I'll say that a bit more if we get around to talking about kind of groups and teams more generally.
Hmm.
But that connection that they make with each other that they might not have before they go out is then made easier being outside, and they bring it back with them. So that's that buzz. But they're also, I said, grounded because they've also been in that natural environment, and they've also engaged in an embodied way with the place that I think is qualitatively different to being seated indoors.
Yes, definitely, for sure. And I think obviously our work is very different to you, but it's been very interesting now that we used to do a lot of work, or our facilitators used to do a lot of work, excuse me, in a face-to-face context, whereas in the last few months, in different parts all around the world, we have been connecting over Zoom or other platforms like this. And the essence of the buzz that you described is really difficult to replicate, not impossible, but much more difficult to replicate in that sense. So facilitators, where you would get the energy from the group and being in the room and the activities you do, have had to make a massive transition. And you would probably find the same in your lectures, I would imagine.
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. You can, I'm sure the people listening to this who are involved in that kind of group work would agree. You don't need to be outside. You can generate all sorts of dynamism inside and face to face with a group. I think at the outside, it adds a real richness to that, whether it's in between or part of that process. But yeah, I mean, I think it's so right. It's so difficult. The same for me, to generate that kind of dynamic. When it's a virtual environment, as you say, there are ways around it, and we're all learning, and it can be done. It's not, you know, there are some positives even, but yeah, it's really difficult. I agree.
Yeah. We are very excited here, Matt, because tomorrow we have our first face-to-face course, certification course here in New Zealand. And we always use the same venue, which has that sort of indoor-outdoor flow, so that we can open up the doors and we can go outside and do an activity outside. And it's really, you know, it's still a hotel, it's still a conference center, but we do always choose venues like that for that very reason, that we can easily move, weather permitting, some of those activities, so people really can engage both inside and outside. And it's amazing, the physical shift just helps people transit from one activity to the next activity, to the next learning piece. And also some quiet time where we can just either put on some quiet music or just take time for reflection, that pause thing that we referred to. So that's all part of what we do in our teaching, which is quite interesting how it connects with what we're aiming to do. But definitely, it's been a really interesting few months for all of us. And I was talking to a group on Zoom the other day and telling them we had this course coming up. What was really interesting for me, there was a spontaneous round of applause. It was almost like, yes, we're going to be able to go back into the room.
Yeah. I've got that feeling now. I almost want to break into applause. Yeah, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Things change. I do really feel that, wow, that really does feel like a breakthrough. Mm. And yet, you know, not so long ago, that would have seemed relatively normal.
Yeah.
I just pick up on that, what you said about the pause. It reminds me of something else, actually. One of the groups that I work with for people with mental health difficulties, but what they built into their group exercises in nature was just that kind of ability to pause whenever anyone wanted. And sometimes these kinds of interventions are really geared towards being active in different activities for good reason, but the people involved really found that beneficial, really appreciated that there was no push or no expectation that they should engage or had to engage with activities at all, or throughout a day or a session, and they could be on their own with support if they needed it and have time out. And as I said, people really do value that that moment's reflection or pause, I think, when they're particularly out in nature and involved in group activities.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's also a bit of a passion of mine in when you're doing facilitation, that you factor into your facilitation time for reflection, to allow people to journal, make their notes, allow other people just simply to think, because you're often thinking, right, between 10 and 10:30, we do this activity, then we move on to this activity. And very many people do not factor in that time for a little bit of reflection or pausing. And I think it's so essential to ground, going back to one of your words earlier, ground what learning has already happened.
Yeah.
Matt, can I move on and just talk to something you mentioned before? And I wanted to ask you to expand upon this. One of the things that you mentioned in your article was about a human right, and access to nature is not equal, especially all around the globe. Just wondered if you could talk about that from your perspective for a moment, please.
Yeah, so the most straightforward way of articulating that, I think, is that in the UK context, and in the global context too, it will depend on where you are. But there are existing inequalities, and depending on geography, ethnic minority, educational background, wealth, that already mean people are more likely to suffer from mental health issues and another range of kind of connected range of issues there. But what's really startling, I suppose, is that also the same thing applies to access to nature. So on all sorts of measures, so whether we measure literally the distance from quality, however that's defined, natural environments, to where one lives, the amount of time and ease with accessing it really is divided along those lines too. So if we think about life chances and mental health already being negatively correlated with these kinds of issues, if we accept or argue that contact with nature is really important for well-being, then not having that access is confounding those kinds of issues. So there's that side of it, for sure. On the other hand, there's this bigger issue around justice and inequality for me, in that we can't assume that nature is this external inert resource that we can just have access to as if it was medication. Nature itself is in retreat. That's part of the ecological crisis that we're living through. So for me, a justice issue is also about reciprocity, about understanding that to be in these natural environments, we also need to start recognizing that we need to give things back, that there needs to be a kind of mutual healing or reciprocal restoration, let's say, in these kinds of spaces too. So, yeah, I think justice in terms of rights is important in both those senses.
Definitely. And it's interesting. I don't know if you've ever been to Singapore, Matt, but that's a country which is very, is very small, very densely populated, very high rise. And yet their government is very much focused on making sure that people do have access to open spaces and protecting, the natural environment that can, or even sometimes man-made environments. But it's really important that governmentally, they've actually encouraged, I think, that for their society. So they're really a really interesting culture and very, I think, very forward thinking. We're very privileged to work with them on a number of occasions at Tetramap.
Yeah, it sounds so. I mean, there's some positive examples all over the globe, aren't there? One I often talk to my students about is in Japan and South Korea, two places where forest bathing has really taken off. Not just as an individual pastime. There's a real governmental approach there as well, in that forest, what we might think of as forest wardens, are being retrained to kind of facilitate these forests and help look after them and encourage people into them and to think about them as a different kind of space. So
wouldn't it be wonderful if this coronavirus that we're in the middle of right at the moment would generate more jobs like that for people? Wouldn't that just be a wonderful outcome of the situation that we're facing right now?
wouldn't it? And it'd be real joined up thinking, wouldn't it? Because I'm sure you've seen similar kinds of reports to me about people rediscovering and reconnecting with nature because they've got more time or because spaces have been opened up. So yeah, to capitalise on that would be wonderful, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that, I think New Zealand have done a fair bit of that so far, but it would be great to see it going much further. And I was going to talk about this point that you talked about, restoration projects. We, one year for our Christmas party at Tetramap, we decided to do something. We always like to do alternative things. So we decided to get involved in a restoration. There's this big project through a sustainable business network here, that, and it's called the Million Meter Stream Project. So it's about restoration of the streams. So we hopped on a ferry and joined up with a group and did some for a day work in terms of pulling out, you know, weeds and all things like that in streams, and did a bit of tree planting in the afternoon. And then in the evening, we went to one of the wineries and had a, you know, wine and cheese platter and things like that. And it was just the best Christmas party ever.
It sounds like, I think I'd be in my element then, Louise, for sure. Yeah.
So things like that, I think are starting to take off. You know, we don't need more stuff, but just doing things together outside the office, using nature as a resource. And if people look, these things are all around and available, I reckon.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, yeah, we know all this instinctively anyway, and it's kind of revisiting or returning to them at the right time sometimes. You know, reciprocal restoration is the kind of thing that you're talking about there, you know, mutually beneficial. Of course it makes sense, you know.
Yeah. What do they say? It might be common sense, but it's not always common practice.
I like that. I'm going to take that away, yeah.
All right, Matt, anything else you'd like to add on that sort of broader topic before we start talking about teams and that kind of thing?
No, I think we've covered it. I mean, hopefully you can provide a link to that article.
I definitely will, for sure.
Pick up on that, but I think we've covered the ground there.
All right. Well, one thing that I just wanted to leave as our final question is, Tetramap really focuses on developing great teams. And I wondered if there's something on that topic that, you know, you would like to share as a gift for some of our listeners to leave them with.
Yeah, I mean, I would. Yeah, I think nature-based principles and assumptions are a really rich source, actually, for building and maintaining positive groups and teams. I could just think of a couple of related senses to finish on. The social side, which I've touched on, social development. I've seen this a lot, evaluating the benefits of what we call nature-based interventions in groups, often for the specific purpose of overcoming experiences of psychological distress and trauma. But I really do believe that they've got a more general application in terms of the social benefits. And the idea there is fairly simple, but it's just that nature contact, if repeated and guided and well supported, a kind of cultivation of nature connectedness, if you create that space and engage people in it, I've just seen it happen again and again and again, where being in nature more often, that cultivating that with groups, deepens and broadens social connections over time in a way that just cannot happen indoors. And it's often for people who have struggled with those very connections, and in ways, ends up doing so in ways that they feel carry over into the rest of their life. It's a real, really common response, and something I've written about a lot. So it might be a philosophical assumption about a kind of nature times social connection, but it's one confirmed by reality again and again for me. And I suppose a related point to that to finish on is what I've seen as an educator, as the role of nature and nature contact in learning. And we touched on this earlier, it's about kind of bodily involvement with the environment, how important that is. And you and your listeners probably know much more than me about this anyway, in terms of what the work you do. But research too into nature therapy has established this. You know, there are many known benefits that involve the stimulation of our sensory motor systems, sight, smells, sounds, and tactile stimulation, just as simple as walking in an environment. And there are all sorts of theories about this that I won't go into any detail about. Kaplan's attention restoration theory is famous in psychology. But it's basically just about cultivating what's referred to sometimes as soft fascination. And I love that term.
That's a new one on me, Matt.
Yeah. Soft fascination. Just that, again, it's simple. When we're in natural environments, they're capable of holding our attention. But at the same time, we can entertain, we can engage in a particularly reflective mode. And it's in those modes that our comprehension and our connections between thoughts or situations can fizz and whir, and but in a relaxed and reflective way. And that's in contrast to hard fascination, which is often working environments that demand full attention, or it might be sporting events or watching TV. They're still seen as that kind of hard fascination. So there are more complex ideas here around kind of embodied cognition and how that works. But I really like this idea of soft fascination as being a really important basis for learning and firing off new connections at a neural as well as a cognitive level. So I think as a kind of learning and social processes involved are really important there for kind of team building and teamwork. But yeah, I'll stop there. I think that's probably enough, isn't it?
Well, I think I was fascinated by that. I was hoping you were going to say a bit more, Matt, to be honest with you. But I've never heard that term before, soft fascination.
Yeah, so yeah. It's a bit...
I wonder if you could send us a link so some of us could read a bit more if we're interested. I just never heard of it before.
Yeah, so it's the Kaplans, as in Kaplan and Kaplan, K-A-P-L-A-N.
Right.
Two of them, husband and wife team. It was their theory of attention restoration.
Okay.
One of the earliest theories around why what we get out of being in nature, how it works for us. And that was just one of the concepts in it. And
wow.
Yeah, it really appeals to me because it's about cognition, but it's also embodied, you know, an embodied experience.
Well, I think that sounds like reading that would be a great gift for our listeners to actually help them understand why this is so important. And I'm sure that would spark off a lot more ideas of the way that they could encourage some of this into the programs that they're delivering with TetraMap as part of it. I'd love to learn more. I'm sure for me that's already sparked off about 10 ideas in my head, but then I'm quite high on fire, so I have ideas coming in all the time.
Well, that's the gift then. So it's a secondhand gift because I'm not pretending I came up with it, but I've used it in different settings, and
it's recycling that gift, Matt.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I hope your listeners find that useful as a very least a touchstone, as you say, for thinking about the work they do with nature.
Brilliant. Well, it's been fascinating, Matt. I could really talk more about this for quite a lot longer, but we're just about out of time. So before we close, is there anything else you'd like to add? Just as anything else we haven't touched on.
No, not really. I think we covered everything. What else did I want to say about teams? I don't think so. That final question, on a wider level, I suppose, in terms of leadership, thinking about leadership as well. That's something we haven't talked about.
Okay.
I think what we can learn from nature is just about the importance of reverence as well. You know, recognizing that the reciprocity of nature and the dynamism and the complexity, and leadership in these times needs to be about seeing the self as part of nature, I suppose, and rather than something we have control over, and seeing those interconnections. And in that sense, power is about things like tending and nurturing and gifting and sharing more than ever.
Mm. And those are very important attributes for leaders to consider at the moment, because nothing is defined, everything is uncertain, and all we know is that we can be kind and generous and look after each other as well as look after the environment that we're in. Nature will find a way to restore. Humans, we're not too sure about, but nature will find a way to restore itself as long as we don't continue to destroy the gift of nature that we've all been given, right?
Yeah, so let's see if we can hang in there and be part of the solution.
Absolutely. That sounds like a really positive way to end. So thank you, Matt, so much for joining us on the In Your Element podcast. I'll make sure that in the show notes we've got your connections. If anybody wanted to connect with you, what would be the best way? Would that be a link via LinkedIn or something like that, Matt?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it'd be fine. I'm on Twitter as well. So, yeah, we can.
And we'll put your book and your article and this article that you just referred to in the last few moments as well in there, so that people have got further reading if they so want it.
Excellent. Yeah, be great. Thank you. It's been really nice speaking to you, Louise.
It's been our pleasure. Thank you, Matt, and take care.
Cheers. Bye.
All the best. Bye-bye.